Okay, welcome back to the Beit Midrash, April 10th, Wednesday. We're in Masechet Tani, and we are going to read the last part of chapter 2 that we're going to learn together, so we can start the Mishnah in chapter 3 and get into some of the material there. But, of course, we can't sail right past the halachic inyan, the issue that comes up in this part of chapter 2. So open to page 18b2, if you're using the art scroll. 18b, or Yudchet Bet.
I can eventually
figure. Yeah. And we're going to look into the Gemara, where I'm just going to bring you into the issue they're talking about, and that is they're trying to figure out what days can you start a fast or a series of fasting on. And so that's the general category here. And I want to bring us kind of into a conversation just so you get a taste of a couple of those discussions, and there's a mention of a certain 2 days that you might have heard of that, oh, you didn't realize was mentioned already in Masechet Ta'anit. It's not just an outside the Gemara kind of day that was noticed or noted in alternative texts. It's right here in the Gemara these days were mentioned, and what are those days? And so on 18b2, you see the Gemara is answering, but we're just taking it up because these are the issues of the days that we can have fasts on. Amar Rav Ashi, I'm at the top of the left-hand column, Hashta ich gufe batluhu. Now that the sages have abolished the festival status of the day of Turianus itself, because of a tragic event that later occurred on that date, Mishum yom nikanor nekum venigzar. Shall we then decree a prohibition against fasting merely because it's the day before the day of Nicanor? Surely not. Okay, so, in other words, we're trying to figure out what days are okay to proclaim the fast, and we have these days on the calendar, and we see that one has been abolished in terms of the festival status, and we're talking about Yom Nicanor. So what are these? The Gemara is going to explain the backgrounds of the celebrations of Nicanor and Turianus. Now, another little preface to these sections. So this is due warning, if you will, that we're talking about rated R for violence. That we're just gonna be. So I just want to just put that out there. I know that we can handle these things, but I think it's fair to make a little bit of a warning when something's going to come up and has the power to shock, like these violent passages have the power to shock. Okay. My Nicanor, my Turianus. What is the day of Nicanor, and what is the day of Turianus? Titania, it was taught in a Braita, and we have this in idiomatic insertion here, of Megillas Tanis. What is Megillas Tanis? Not going to really dwell on it, but we have an edition, or several editions, of Megillat Ta'anit, which is not the same as Masechet Ta'anit, the tractate that we're learning. But it's a book that talks about days that it's good to fast on, days that it's not possible to fast on. It talks about fasts that used to be in Jewish history. So we have versions of that. A major manuscript of Megillat Ta'anit, the Megillah of Fasts, was recently done by an Israeli publishing house. Less critical editions have been circulating. And it's obviously from, or according to the Gemara, it's from the days of the Tanaim, because you see it says in a Braita, from that Megillah. So it's putting us back in that time frame. Nicanor echad mi iparche yevanim haya. Nicanor was a Greek governor. Uvechol yom v'yom haya meinif yado al Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. And each and every day he would wave his hand against Judah and Jerusalem, v'omer, and boast, Ematai tipol b'yadi ve'erem asena. When will it fall into my hand, and I shall be able to trample it? Uchesheg avra malchut beit chashmonai v'nitzchum. And when are we talking about? The time of the Hasmoneans, right? We're talking about Maccabees, and then the Hashmonaim. So we're talking about what? 170s, 160s, 150s BCE. When the Hasmoneans rose up and prevailed, the Hasmonaim cut off Nicanor's thumbs and big toes. Utlaum b'sharei Yerushalayim, and they hung them from the gates of Jerusalem. Ve'amru, and they declared, Pe haya medaber begava, the mouth that used to speak with arrogance, v'yadayim shehayu minifot al Yerushalayim, and the hands that used to wave against Jerusalem, te'asei behem nikama, shall have revenge taken against them. And that was the 13th of Adar.
Apparently they also cut off his head. You know, so the thumbs and toes didn't matter much.
Do we know what they did to the rest of them?
The footnote says...
Look at the footnote.
I don't have the footnote.
Oh, you don't have the footnote. Read the footnote, Arthur.
They cut off his thumbs because he waved his hands against Jerusalem, and his big toes because he threatened to trample Jerusalem. They also cut off his head because his mouth spoke with arrogance.
Right. And it notes, this is not the same Nicanor who brought special gifts to the temple in Yoma.
Oh, right, right.
So you have some confusion, right? Nicanor is a popular name, obviously, in the time period. Could be. So you have this description, and you have that it's the 13th, and the sages declared that date a minor festival on which one may neither fast nor eulogize. What's the problem with that? That we have Purim. Right. So, obviously, that gets nullified. And you can declare a fast on such a day that there used to be a possible reason why you wouldn't have a fast. And so the question of which days can you fast and which days can't you fast is of my primary concern at this point. But it's also just to run through this brief history of these days that were described in what we call Megillat Tanit, because we can't leave the second parak of Tanit without mentioning that there is such a thing as Megillat Tanit, and as it's notes down there, you can find this name of this other person, of this person in Yoma, and people say, wait a minute, didn't Nicanor give the temple gifts? Yes, that Nicanor did in Yoma, but over here in Tanit, you have him bragging and boastfully trying to overcome Yerushalayim. The date over here?
Yeah.
That's mentioned in Megillat Tanit. Art Scroll is bringing you what's mentioned in Megillat Tanit.
Isn't Purim 14th of Adar?
It is.
It's in the 13th, the fast of...
Right, exactly. So that's the issue here.
Yeah. Oh.
So if this was a day of Yontif,
how
could I have a fast?
Right.
Ah, but it must be that we now say we don't celebrate that anymore, or... You know, there's lots of different thoughts about why such a day would be overturned. I want to read it outside of any of the kind of svaras that circulate and say, with such a violent story, is that what you want to promote on the 13th of Purim?
And that's like,
or do you want to promote fasting for the power of salvation?
And this happened, this incident, like 200-300 years after.
Exactly. So, should that day of fasting be turned now to a day of Yontif, or can I fast on that day?
Is there a reason it's not specifically mentioned?
That
issue of Tanit Esther and Purim.
That's mentioned beforehand. I'm bringing you into the discussion, as I mentioned. Okay. We didn't read all the pages and discussions beforehand. No. let's push forward. Maitrianus. And what is the day of Turianus? It was taught. Amru. Kishevi kesh Turianus laharoget Lulianus ufapos achiv beludkia. When Turianus sought to kill Lulianus and Papos, his brother in Lucia, Amar lahem, he said to them, if you're from the nation of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, right, where do they come from? Book of
Daniel.
Yavo Eloichem v'yatzil etchem miyadi. Let your God come and save you from my hand. K'derech she'yatzil et Hananiah, Mishael, v'Azariah miyad Nebuchadnezzar. Just like he saved Mishael, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, as the book of Daniel recounts. Amrulo, they replied to him, Hananiah, Mishael, v'Azariah, tzadikim gemurim hayu. They were completely righteous men. Ure'uyin hayu le'asot lahem nes. And they were deserving of that very miracle that happened for them. Nebuchadnezzar melech hagun haya. Nebuchadnezzar was a proper king, v'ra'uy le'asot nes al yado, who was deserving that a miracle be wrought through him. But that evil one, you, Turianus, you're a commoner. Hedyot. Who's not deserving that a miracle be wrought through you. In other words, you're not part of the great vicissitudes of history through which miracles are going to come and happen on the earth. And we're not righteous, but we're liable to destruction for sinning to the or against the omnipresent. And if you don't kill us, the Holy One has many executioners, and the Omnipresent has many bears and lions in his world, who attack us and murder us. But the Holy One, did he? Blessed is he, did not place us into your hand, except in order to eventually avenge our blood from your hand. Nevertheless, despite the threat of divine vengeance, Turianus killed them immediately. Amru, the sages reported, lo zazu misham, no one had moved from there, ad shebao de yulfle meromi, until a pair of officers came from Rome bearing an imperial edict against Turianus. Ufatzu et mocho begizrin, and they split open his head with clubs. And since this incident occurred on the 12th of Adar, the sages declared the date a minor festival. So up there, when we started the passage 18b2 at the left-hand corner of the page, we said that the sages had abolished the festival status of the day of Turianus. And if I abolish the day of a festival status, I can then what? Call a fast. But if it was that it had a festival status, I couldn't have a fast on that day. So I had days from Megillat Tanit, is the point that I want to just make in general with this section, that could not be a day upon which a fast is decreed. And there were lots of different reasons given previously that we really didn't read together. One of them was more practical, a marketplace matter. If I'd start a series of fasts on a Thursday, it might cause the marketplace to not only sell food to break the fast on a Thursday, but since I need so much food for all the Shabbat, they're going to raise prices. And it's going to cause market fluctuation in a way that's not good for customers. So I need to plan it accordingly and have a Monday, Thursday, Monday set of fasts so that I can space out. This is the Gemara's proposition, by the way. So how this works exactly economically, don't exactly ask me. So I want to have it work out correctly for the marketplace, so the shuk, so they're doing marketplace matters. However, they're purchasing power and purchasing patterns played out in the world. This, in terms of the day or the holiday upon which a fast can or cannot be decreed becomes another part of the conversation. So I have certain patterns of time that I have to respect when it comes to declaring fasts for the community, and I have certain days in the calendar that I have to respect vis-a-vis my ability to declare upon them a fast for the community.
When we first started reading, it was talking about the 13th, Father, and here it comes in the 12th.
Right, right. Now this is a different day. That was the Yom Nicanor. Now we're talking about Yom Tirianus. And again, all this in the greater conversation, not only of Purim, and what our custom is vis-a-vis the Ta'anit Esther and what we do with Purim, but what we do when it comes to decreeing a fast on the community, and it's Adar, and such calamity has befallen us that we haven't had rain in forever, and we need fasts to be declared, what do we do? And what dates are available to us and what dates are not available to us. And that's the context. To finish up this little piece on the right-hand side over here, the Gemara resumes the discussion of the Mishnah, which states, Ein gozrin tanit al tzibor b'tchila chamishi. We don't decree upon the community a series of fasts beginning on a Thursday. Ein gozrin tanit b'roshei chodeshim. And we may not decree a fast on the community on Rosh Chodesh. The Gemara asks, down to the next piece, Uvechama havaya atchala. And what constitutes a commencement of a series of fasts? That we don't interrupt it even if a fast coincides with Rosh Chodesh, Chanukah, Purim. Because the chap on the Mishnah was that if you had announced a set of fasts and Rosh Chodesh came or Chanukah came or Purim came, that you don't interrupt it. But for big yontivs, serious yontivs, you would interrupt it, okay? What constitutes a decree of fasts that you really commenced? Rav Acha says it's shalosh, it's three fasts. Rav Asi says it's even one fast. Meaning what to him? That let's say we really needed to fast for something, and Hanukkah is coming. So by him, if you decreed it, and it was going to be the Hanukkah, because you were waiting until maybe let's do the scenario in our heads, the next Monday to start the fast, or that was going to be your fast day, but it was Hanukkah, but you really needed to decree the fast now, you could still do it, because you decreed it. That's considered a commencement. But really, according to Rav Acha, if I took it so seriously as to declare three fasts on the community, Monday, Thursday, and Monday, look, that's what the Rashi says, three fasts. So then, I needed to be three fasts and not just one fast day, in order to have that really go into these periods of time where I might feel as though, or I might have the ruling that I can't have the fasts in the community because of the days on the calendar. Yeah? So these issues of making decisions about what day we fast really close out the Mishnah that brought up the whole question of when do you decree it? And what days are you doing it? And what day do you start it? And are there certain days in the calendar that are possible and not possible? And just remember that the Mishnah, and you don't have to turn back if you don't want to, but I'm going to go back to 15b3 to close it out again. The Mishnah had said, we don't decree a fast on the community for Rosh Chodesh, Chanukah, or Purim. V'im hitchilu ein mafsikim. However, once they've commenced a series of fasts, they don't interrupt it when one of the days falls on Rosh Chodesh, Chanukah, or Purim. That's the very Rav Gamliel. Rabbi Meir said, Af al pi shema Rabban Gamliel ein mafsikin. Even though Rav Gamliel said they don't interrupt the ongoing fast, modeh hayasha ein mashlimin, he conceded that they don't complete any fasts on all those days. Rather, they break their fast shortly before sunset. So in other words, you get a little bit of a reprieve on how long the fast goes. And what we said about that, in terms of custom and practice, for the second chapter to be done, was that we really didn't get an exact time calculation when they say they start the fast but they don't complete it. Which just leaves me to comment at the end here that we have, a question about, okay, what's the real ruling now about what days you can fast and what days you can't fast? And halachic codes take care of that, right? In addition to one other proof text that I want to bring in a second. And then the question of what does it mean to start your fast and not mashlim? That kind of doesn't get answered except for a few certain halachic sources who find a way to say that after Mincha Gedola, if that's your community's tradition, or after Plaga Mincha, which is your, if it's your community's tradition to daven then, that maybe you fasted enough for a certain fast day within our tradition, and you should be able to break your fast after you read the Torah and say the special Haftarah for the fast day, earlier on in the day than sundown, when we would say by the majority of the community, that's when the fast really ends. So these discussions continue, particularly in the conservative community, where Rabbi David Glinken has created a tshuva that says that breaking fast in the mincha hours of a day is one way to be mashlim a fast that commemorates a moment of great calamity and destruction in Jewish history, actually fulfill your obligation. But since we have Israel in our hands, even while we build it in terms of the glory that we hope for there to be one day, that one is permitted to break their fast early. Now, I think, if I remember correctly, and I don't have the tshuva in front of me, so I'm going to say this, and I'm on recording saying this. I have to go back and read the tshuva. Nobody takes this as halachic advice. I think he says this for 17 Tammuz, but does not say this for Tisha B'Av. And so too the other minor fasts, by the way. So before we leave that issue, I want to bring you into this from our Mativta Gemara, that this issue of when is it permissible to fast, when is it not permissible to fast. From what we know in general, kind of halachic and cultural reality of the Jewish people, when is it not permitted to fast? On what day?
Shabbat.
That's when we say, like, in general, you ask somebody, when do we know we don't fast? Except for one holiday that can fall on Shabbat and be a fast. Yom Kippur. Now, we know we don't live in the kind of culture and cultural reality where we hear major decrees for 3 days of fasting anyhow. That's not kind of the rhythm and the culture that we live in. That's not our Jewish drum. But I wanted to relate to this question of Isur Tanit B'Shabbat. Because sometimes what we do know, in terms of the Shul calendar, is that when a fast really does fall on the Sabbath, we wind up seeing that the actual date of the fast is moved. Right? So 17th of Tammuz falls on Shabbat, we don't fast, and we do the fast on the 18th of Tammuz, which we will do this summer. On a Sunday. So the issue of fasting on Shabbat interested me, and they had a wonderful article back here in this Mativta Gemara. And so I'll read you a little bit from it. Makor ha-halacha. Mevuar b'gemara she'ein mitani b'Shabbat. It's made clear in the Gemara that you don't fast on Shabbat. Va'af ta'anit tzibur. Even a fast of the public. Ve'im chal tisha b'av b'Shabbat nidche tanit liyom rishon. Even if tisha b'av falls on that Shabbat, you push it off till Sunday as well. Ba'od shaninu b'braita she'im chal lehiyot tisha b'av b'erev Shabbat mevi'in lo k'beitzav ochel k'dei shelo yikanes l'Shabbat k'shehu meuneh. So even when you did fast the day before a Shabbat, and it's Tisha B'Av, because that we'd hold pretty true to, you bring him something to eat before the Sabbath, so you don't go into Shabbat completely feeling afflicted in your soul, completely feeling dilapidated by without enough energy to enter Shabbat and to take Shabbat, to accept Shabbat on you. Which, by the way, like most opinions would be that you would wait until after Maariv to eat something. So it's saying if you thought that way, you don't need to wait that long. You'd eat something before you went into the Sabbath, which normally you wouldn't do because you want to be very ready to make blessings over your challah and to really make Sudat Shabbat on a Friday night. Shelo rachta anit shel yom shalem asura b'Shabbat. Not only is the fool's fast on the day of Shabbat forbidden, ela afta anit shel sha'achat bilvad asura. You don't even fast for an hour on Shabbat. So you're taking Tosfot Shabbat, you're going to add a little Kedusha on the Shabbat, you eat a little something, and you start Shabbat as you would. V'chein matzinu b'masechtin, in our Gemara, shekol yamim tovim hen min haTorah v'hen min divrei sofrim, whether it's rabbinic or from Torah, v'elu hashnuyim b'megilat tanit, even the ones in Megilat Tanit that we keep, asurim b'hefsed b'tanit, you don't, b'hesped b'tanit, you don't have a eulogy or a fast. Uva'elu shehen mevigilat tanit hosifu chizuk l'divrehem sh'af b'yamim shalifneihem l'achareihem asurim b'hesped b'tanit. And even sometimes you had in Megillat Tanit that scroll of fasts. No fasting on the day of the yontiv that they declared and made from their own rabbinic kind of decree, but the day before and the day after. So that piece here is saying, we had the power to really make decisions about what days you can fast on and what days you can't fast on. Rambam katav. Rambam said, she'im nishba lehitanot b'shabbat v'yom tov. Let's say a person himself takes on an oath, swears, to take on a fast for some purpose. Nechshav shivuat shav kadim. It's absolute erroneous and nullified oath. What would you say? Shvuat Shav. It's for naught. It's moot. V'Shulchan Aruch nifsach she'asur lehitano b'Shabbat. And in the Shulchan Aruch, the major law code of Yosef Karo, 16th century, forbidden to fast on Shabbat, v'afim eino mit'anei yom shalem eila rak ad chatzot asur. Even if you take on a partial kind of fast. V'chatav v'veyor agra, and the gra says, shedin ze nilmad mima shematzinu b'gemara. We learn that from what's said in the Talmud. Shelo lehikanes l'shabbat k'shehu meune. So, in other words, I was talking about Friday, that even if you take on some fast, no, you really have to finish it up by midday, because you can't go into Shabbat feeling afflicted or feeling kind of depleted is the better word. Thank you. I said dilapidated before. I was looking for depleted. Harei she'af shelo yita'aneh b'chol ha-Shabbat ela rak sha'achat asur. In other words, an hour of fasting is forbidden. We found in the Midrash that helps us work out the whole dates problems that asur l'shev b'ta'anit b'Shabbat she'im chal yud dalet lihiyot b'echad b'Shabbat asur l'hitanot b'Shabbat u'v'erev Shabbat nami asur mivnei Torah ha-Shabbat. So the Midrash expands it and says, wait a minute, if the 13th is coming and it's going to be a fast, like on the fast of Esther, and it's right before the 14th, we wouldn't do it. Eila maktimin u'mitanin b'chamishi. Rather, we move the fast back to Thursday, Shehu Echadasar Vadar. That's already the 11th of Adar. So we really make some adjustments to the calendar. V'kavod Shabbat Adif Me'elef Taniot. The holiness and the honor of the Sabbath is preferred over 1,000 fasts that you could possibly fast. Uchavod Shabbat de'oraita, and honoring the Sabbath is a Torah law. V'ta'anit de'rabanan, and the fast is a de'rabanan category. V'ati kavod Shabbat de'oraita, and kavod of Shabbat is Torah. V'dochi ta'anit de'rabanan, and is going to put off, push away, nullify any kind of fast that's committed, that Chazal has committed us to. Umivuar belishono shekavod Shabbat hum deraita, and it's said that we really need to truly respect the Torah origins of Shabbat, v'hen tzarich la'achin ha'ma'achalim, and we need to fix the right kind of foods. She'im ein mitzvah min ha'Torah le'achol b'Shabbat, ma'achashash she'itbatel mikavod Shabbat. In other words, let me encourage you, those of you who cook for Shabbat, this has got to be done. This has got to be done. Can't say, I know, it's more spiritual and more powerful and more coveted to fast. You know, it's talking about the very practical nature of things. What's beautiful is this. In terms of that, I can't ever be in the mode of nullifying the sanctification and the honor of Shabbat. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, Katav B'Piyuto, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who we know is a great scholar, great astrologist, great science thinker of his time, great insightful translator, Python, poetry writer, Ki Eshmera Shabbat, that one is to guard the Sabbath. Katav Zelishono, this is what he wrote, Rasham Badat Ha'el, that's written in the law of the Lord, Chok El Seganav, a law to all of his ministers, Vol Aroch Lechem Panim Lefanav, that you should organize the wonderful breads of the Sabbath before him. Al Kain, and thusly, Lihit Anot Bo Al Pi Nivonav Asur. It is absolutely forbidden to work away, work out a way, even halachically, in terms of what you believe is your authority, to fast on the Sabbath. Now, what I loved about this was that in this wonderfully halachic discussion with all the sources and the way the article was unfolding, that it brought Ibn Ezra's Zemer Shel Shabbat. It brought his song, his poem, as a proof text. So I want to look at this a little bit more closely for a second. There it is.
So what we're assuming is that Yom Kippur, with all that was said about Shabbat, still overrides everything that was said.
So, and Ibn Ezra wants you to know that. And Ibn Ezra, in a genius kind of way, I want to give you now the context for one of the stanzas of Ki Eshmera Shabbat. And what he's doing here is not simply writing a poem about the wonderful, beautiful nature of the Sabbath and the delight of the Sabbath. What he is doing is that he has come up with a way to really create a public education campaign. That the Zemer that he wrote, I want to say, is not only beautiful poetry in and of itself, based in halachic sources and his understanding of Torah and the foundational kind of approaches that you need to take as a rabbinic Jew. But what he did is, in that great movement of Zmirot that sometimes wax poetically about the delights of the Sabbath and the foods of the Sabbath and that it was a day of the Lord and my soul thirsts, here he really teaches us a halachic, it's like a small halachic compendium about the Sabbath and about the nature of the Sabbath. And I just found that to be delightful, that you could see this really as a piece of public education, the same way that this book is presenting it as a piece of public education. And he's doing it for the population at the Sabbath table and circulating it widely. You see it down on below. Dr. Raymond Shinlin from the seminary said that Ki Eshmera Shabbat was composed by Ibn Ezra. The poem uses a stanza pattern that was very popular for sung poetry among Muslims and Jews in medieval Spain. The first three lines of each stanza rhyme, but this rhyme is different in each stanza. The last line of each stanza has the same rhyme as all the other last lines, and this rhyme is anticipated in the two-line heading that today serves as a refrain. The poem's contents consist of a versification of some of the laws of Shabbat, an unusual theme for Ibn Ezra, by the way, who was not a codist. He was not a halachist, per se, writing Shabbat. He was a teacher.
When did he
Even as with dates?
He was born 1098.
1098.
And then he
died 1165. Yeah. It says here
1092 to
1167.
There's a debate
here. Yeah, there is a debate. Yeah. And, you know, exact times, they didn't have a stone that says exactly his dates. But I thought this might be the first time in Talmud class history that we sing a Shabbos Zemer on a Wednesday night. So here we go. If you know a different tune after this one, I'll take it. I think I know two, but we'll sing this.
I'll hear a few musical
verses. You found a few. Well, we'll sing it aloud. I don't know if you've ever sang this Zemer at your Shabbat table or you've done it here at the synagogue, but just a wonderful entree to the laws of the Sabbath. And it gets into the fasting issue in the third stanza. Ki yeshmer ha-shabbat el yishmereini oti le'omead beino veini oti le'omead beino veini asor mitzochefetz asoterachim gamilidaber bo divrei tzerachim divrei sechora ach divrei melachim ege betorat el utchakameini oti leomead beino veini oti leomead beino veini boem tzatamid nofesh lenafshi hine ledorishon natan kedoshi mofet betzed lechem mishne bashishi kacha bechol shishi yachpil mezoni oti leol meyad beino veini oti leol meyad beino veini rasham bedat ha'el chok el siganav bo la'aroch lechem panim lefanav gam bo lehitanot al pi nevonav asur levad miyom kippur avoni oti leol meyad beino veini oti leol meyad beino veini. So you see in that last stanza he wrote that Torah for the priests. I talked about it, the ministers, the Jewish people, to arrange bread. Spiritually you connect with that idea. Fasting on it according to the sages is forbidden except for the Day of Atonement for one's sins. Of course when he says according to the sages, nivonat, this is a deraita idea, right? This is a deraita category. By the Torah, you're to make sure that you are set for Shabbat, you are not fasting on Shabbat. Levad mi yom kippur avoni, except for the Day of Atonement for one's sins. And there are those who, when we've looked at the song before in the context of the greater repertoire of Shabbat Smirot, have noticed that in fact he, as just a very deep religionist, wants such respect for the Sabbath, respect for the laws of the sages, respect for rabbinic realities that way. Matters of commerce and politics are asur. Divrei schora af divrei melachim. Right? Except what is? Ege b'torat el. Ponder God's Torah. To really study Torah on the Sabbath and really be involved in text study and Gemara study and the like came out of his recommendations. Though he was very engaged in other pursuits during Chol, if you will, his Shabbat engagements were very, very, he was very strict about these kinds of matters. And laying on top of that, the kind of halachic teaching he's trying to do, mentioning that the Day of Atonement is for one's sins, kind of gives you the whole picture of of, you know, his true connection to all the aspects of the Jewish faith, along with the encounters with Muslim Spain and all, again, of those other kind of worldly chokmas, wisdoms that he pursued in his life. So I think this is a brilliant piece that reflects from Masechet Tanit some of the contents of chapter 2.
What about a fast day that falls on a otherwise celebratory day? For instance, a Brit Milah or a wedding?
Ah,
what
nice.
About that?
So, if a bris, because you want to say eighth day is a bris, right?
It must be.
So what happens? There is a halachic position that on that day after Shachri, the bris happens, because this is a typical kind of scenario, right? The bris happens right after Shachri. I suppose it could happen otherwise, but I'll just use the tshuva that popped into my head, and you have to say that there's a suda, right?
Right.
So who makes the suda? Can the minyan that attended the bris make the suda? Or can the bala brit make the suda? The father only? Father and immediate family? Or no one? So this is the discussion that ensues. And so the generally accepted way that I've seen it in communities that really pursue this, and the general way I've seen it done, is that not in front of everyone to say, look at me, I got the nice bagel and lox, and you're sitting there fasting, but that the Bala Brit privately and modestly goes and has a suda the day that he is lachniso, the day that he does the bris for his son. Now, whether or not the rest of the family is eating with them, I don't really know, but I know that a father of a little baby who's had a bris goes and makes that bris. I would imagine that the immediate family is included in halachic literature. I haven't really dealt with the issue halachically deeply enough to tell you exactly everything, but it's a very interesting question, right? Who should really be zoche? In the sense that the Gemara says that the bris falls on the community should the father and then the grandfather not follow through in Kiddushim, I might think that there would be a leniency to allow for the community who experienced the bris to actually let that take precedence. However, you could use our Tani Gemara to say, look, we had some days that were little yuntivs in the tradition, and now we allow fasts on them. We've nullified them. And by the sages, we kind of make the distinctions. And so if the whole community is fasting, does that really push off everybody's requirement to fast, or just the father and maybe the mother?
Because if a bris...
The mom held.
Yeah, you would think. But I would imagine that the again, I haven't looked at all of the tshuvot, but I imagine that the moel is not included in that. Even if he was a shaliach.
Even if the bris falls on Yom Kippur, you must have the bris.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes. Yeah. And then, by the way, there's no question, he's still got a fast.
For if it's Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
That's a Torah.
For the rest of the day.
Does it? It's a Torah fast. Yeah.
Right. Deraita, Yom Kippur, no question. But it's a good Shiloh.
Even if he gets a Shabbat. He discusses the when does Shabbat begin and all the calendric stuff around it, but he was very interested. But he ties it into the all the computation of the calendar and beginning of day and night and the week. But I love his Hebrew. For me, it's like music. I'm so used to his style. His Hebrew is wonderful, and he also always has a personal touch. I'm very familiar with his style. It's always a personal touch, and even here,
mm-hmm.
he speaks in the first person.
Where?
The poem.
Emtza.
The poem.
Well,
it's typical of those Sephardic poetry
right.
of the time, but still, it's very Ibn Ezra.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Ege b'toradel, and Emtza tamid. I'll ponder God's Torah. I will always find rest for my soul.
It's very personal.
Yeah.
It's between me and him.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is just beautiful.
And it ends with Avodi.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, I'm not talking about yours.
Exactly.
I'm talking about mine.
It's like taking full responsibility. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Even Ezra, yeah.
I think his religiosity and his worldliness comes through so often in so many of his different commentaries on Torah and then his Shabbat
it
even
song
shows
here. In his astrology, but very little. You have to read between the lines and find it here and there, but you can see how he resolves his religiosity with astrology.
Mm. Nice. Good. Hadran alach teretanit peitsa. Okay, so we're going to come back one day to chapter 2. And we're going to now move to chapter 3. I want to learn this first Mishnah. We'll read the introduction here out loud. In the first chapter, we learned that if the rains did not come by the 17th day of Mar Cheshvan, the distinguished members of the community would fast 3 days. If the rains still didn't come, the rabbis would decree 3 fast days on the entire Jewish community. And if the rains still didn't come, they would decree another 3, subject to even more stringent regulations. And still, if they didn't come, another 7. That got us to our 13th. This gradual progression in the severity of the fast applies only when fasts are declared because the first rains were delayed. However, when faced with other calamities that are deemed to be immediate emergencies, we dispense with the less stringent fast and immediately declare a series of fasts with the most stringent regulations. Our Mishnah begins by listing a few of these emergencies. So what did the world of emergencies look like for our ancestors? Chapter 3. Seder Tani Yorelu Ha'amor. The order of these fasts mentioned above, Berevi'ah Rishonah, applies only when the first rains were delayed. Havat Tzmachim Shishanu. However, if the crops changed and they grew abnormally, which is an emergency, Matrin Aleim Yad. You actually go in Matrin. Look at the verb. What root do you see in Matrin? Tru'ah. Tru'ah. And so therefore we said, like in the first couple of times that we encountered the special liturgies and what instruments we use, the crying out of the shofar was an essential part of the ritual. V'chein shepasku gishamim bein geshem l'geshem arba'im yom. And similarly, if the rains cease to fall for 40 days between the first and then the next, matorin alehen, we cry out immediately. Mivnei shehim makat b'tzor, because this is an affliction that will cause a food shortage. Yardu litzmachin, if rains fell for crops, aval lo yardu leilan, but not for the trees, leilan, velo litzmachin, but not for the crops, lezeh lezeh, or rain fell for both crops and trees, aval lo levorot leshichin lemarot, but not enough to fill the water holes, ditches and caves where water is stored for drinking, matrin alehem yad. In other words, if you have water problems, and it wasn't just the first rains, you're going to go through and do these fasts that we declared on the community for the first rains not coming. Ir shelo yardu aleha gishamim. Similarly, a town which has no rains fall. Maybe even there'll be other towns that had it, but yours is really in trouble. You're going to declare the fast. Tichtiv vehim tarfi al irechat va'al irechat lo amtir. I'll cause it to rain on one city and on one city I'll withhold the rains. Chelka chat timater. One field will be rained on, another one I'll withhold the rain. Ota ir, that city which received no rain, mitanal matarat. That city fasts and calls out. V'chol sevivotea and all the surrounding cities, mitanin velo matriot. They fast, but they don't cry out. In other words, they don't have that same kind of public tefillah. Now Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rabbi Akiva says, Matriot v'lo mitanot, surrounding cities cry out but don't fast, v'chein ir sheyesh ba'dever o mapole. Similarly, a city in which there's pestilence, or a collapse of buildings, or the city wall due to strong winds, ota ir mitana o matrad. That city fasts and cries out. And the rest of the surrounding cities fast, but they don't cry out.
Rabbi Akiva Omer Matal Yod Zalom Mitanos, and Rabbi Akiva says the opposite. They cry out, but they don't fast. Eizahu Dever, what's considered this Dever? Ir Shemotia Chamesh Meot Ragli, a city that can muster 500 men on foot. The Yatzu Mimena Shlosh Meitim, and three persons died naturally. The Shalosh Yamim Zeachar Zeh, on three consecutive days. Hare Zeh Dever. This is considered this kind of disease that we call Dever. So you have an immediate kind of one after the next within 3 days. Pachod mikan, fewer than that, ein ze dever. That's not considered dever. The Mishnah now lists the calamities for which people everywhere fast. Al elu matrein v'chol makom. Those following calamities we cry out everywhere. Wherever news of these calamities arrives, since there's reason to fear, the calamities may spread to those areas. Now, by the way, what are you talking about by way of areas? What is Steinfeld? Does Steinfeld J have an entry for the wherever the areas that are being described? The I forget, the surrounding cities. I think there was one for surrounding cities.
If a specific city is visited by calamity, the people living there must fast and cry out by blowing the shofar. The residents of the surrounding areas must also fast, but they do not cry out.
He doesn't have a little geographic note about what does it mean to be a surrounding. Where was I reading that? So there was a surrounding, like, what is a surrounding city? What's the area? What are we talking about, right? Are there administrative districts? Do we think that they were divided into some kind of administrative districts? Or do we think that ultimately we're just talking about cities that kind of share one either water source or the caves that they share these pits and caves for drinking water, and that we know that they had such kind of connections, that they shared fields for grazing. We're not exactly sure from the Mishnah what kind of definitions are being created, what kind of boundaries and borders are being created, but we get a sense, right, that obviously there's some connectivity among certain cities and areas that share resources and also share experience. Yeah. Okay, so we go to this notion of crying out everywhere. Al shidafon, for wind blasts that ruin grain, but al hayerakon, for yellowing, which we say is that it's basically like drying out. For va'al ha'arbe, va'al ha'chasil, for locusts and for chasil locusts, two different species. Va'ala chayara'a, for dangerous beasts that attack human beings. Va'ala cherev, and for the sword. When you have armies passing through, matri'in alea, we cry out for those calamities, mitnei shehi maka mehalechet, because it's a calamity that travels to other areas. And we're really all calling out because we know the nature of those disasters that not only could strike us, but could strike others. So now let's tell a story. It once happened that the elders of the Sanhedrin went down from Jerusalem to their cities throughout Eretz Yisrael in order to decree a public fast. Dale, I think weeks ago you asked, are we talking about Eretz Yisrael or are we talking about other areas? And so you get evidence in this Mishnah that we're definitely talking about what? Sanhedrin, right? And Mirushalayim. Sh'al shenira'a kimelo pi tanur shidafon ba'ashkelon. Because there appeared the size of an oven's mouth of wind blast damage on grain in Ashkelon, a city located near the southwest border of Eretz Yisrael in an area inhabited by the Philistines in biblical times. The Od Gazru Tanit, they decreed a fast, Al She'achlu Zevim Shnei Tinokot Be'ever Yarden, because wolves had devoured two children over there on that side of the Jordan River. Rabbi Yosi Omer, Lo Al She'achlu, they didn't decree the fast because the wolves had devoured anyone. They didn't eat anyone. Eila al shiniru, just because they had been seen. And we know what kind of calamity can befall a town when they really have those kinds of wolves and wild beasts come within their borders. And you see the idiomatic note, naturally or normally on the Sabbath and on holidays, we're forbidden to fast or offer prayers of supplication. However, now, even though we heard even Israel's song, and we read the article, and we were in the other part of the Gemara, and we know that's Asur, right? However,
in dire circumstances, we're permitted to cry out and pray for relief according to the Mishnah. What circumstances exist that we are deeming them dire? Al elu matriim b'shabbat. These are the following calamities we cry out in prayer on the Sabbath. Anenu Hashem, Anenu, answer us, God, answer us, right? We normally wouldn't thrust those kind of prayers up to God on the Sabbath. Absolutely answer us, God, absolutely answer us. And if we really thought about the religious rites that were defined, we would expect, there might be disagreement about where exactly the shofars were blasted, and if they were blasted only in the temple precincts, or they were blasted by the eastern gate, as we saw that there was some real discussion, but could they be saying that we are actually going to matri'in, meaning make true oath on the shofar, on the Sabbath, right? Because we don't do that outside the temple walls. To the basic understanding we have. But here we were saying we have such calamitous time. Things might be different. Al ir shehi kifuha nochrim, a city that was beleaguered by hostile Gentiles. O nahar, a river that was swelling. Va'al asvina mitzarefet bayam, for a ship that's tossing at sea and is in danger of sinking. Rabbi Yossi Omer, we may cry out for assistance, but we may not call out in prayer exactly. So he's worried that calling out in prayer in this way is not exactly a Sabbath kind of practice. So he says, wait a minute, we still have to recognize Shabbat, but let's say it's like Pikuach Nefesh Dochei on Shabbat to call out for assistance for these things.
It's more like a
bakasha. It's more like a bakasha to the assistance that can actually help you. You know, somebody helps steady the ship.
But not, oh God, how could you do this to me?
Exactly, exactly. And it's for sure not anenu Hashem anenu and make shofar blast.
At least according to Rabbi Yossi.
At least according, right, to Rabbi Yossi. Let's see what Shimon Atimani Omer. Shimon the Timnite says, Ah, Fala Dever, also for pestilence we cry out and pray on the Sabbath. Lo hodu lo chachamim, but the sages did not agree with him. Yeah?
Dever is the plague. It's not pestilence, it's horse. Dever is the plague.
Well, we used it for the plague in Torah and Egypt. That was on a massive scale. Here they're not saying it's on such a massive scale. They're defining in the Mishnah a little bit of a different take on Dever. Maaseh. Now we get into another Maaseh. You might have heard of this famous man. It once happened. Sha'amru lo l'choni ha-me'agil. They said to Choni the Circle Maker. Now if you read 22, Choni was given the title Circle Maker because of the incident now related by the Mishnah. He was named for his extreme piety and was noted for his commitment to understanding Torah. He was greatly pained when something was beyond his comprehension. Accordingly, there was confidence that his prayers would be answered, and they turned to him to pray for rain. So, Choni Amit Hitpalel Sheyerzu Gishamim. Pray that rains should fall. Amar lehem, Choni says to them, Se'u v'achnisu tanurei p'sachim. Go out and bring in the ovens that were prepared for roasting the Pesach offerings. Bishvil shelo yamoku. So they don't dissolve in the rain. Now he was confident, so confident that rains would come with his praying, that he was really worried that the clay ovens that were being prepared to roast the Pesach offerings were going to be, you know, basically washed away. Washed away. Now that's confidence. He palel v'lo yardu yashamim. He prayed, but no rain fell. Sorry, no rain fell. Now that was because of what, generally speaking? According to most Rishonim that comment on the story, it's because he's so chutzpahdik.
some sense.
Arrogant.
If you have something out, you know it's going to get ruined if it rains. You bring it in, and then it doesn't rain.
The umbrella, though. When you take an umbrella, it will not rain.
It'll never rain.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. So this is where it comes from. Obviously.
But why was he called a circle maker?
You can, so you're going to see in a second.
We haven't gotten there yet.
You're going to see in a second, Art.
Shamanic practice.
You too will be able to become a circle maker.
Okay.
Ma'asa.
Those crop circles.
What did he do? Ag uga. He drew a circle. He drew a circle. Ve'amad betocha. And he stood in the middle of the circle. Ve'amar lefanav. And he said to Kodesh Baruch Hu, Ribono shel olam, Master of the Universe. Manecha samu p'nehem alai. Your children turned their faces to me. Shani kaven bayit lefanecha. I'm like a child of your dwelling house. I'm a member of your household. Nishbani bishimcha gadol. I swore to them by your great name, she'eini zaz mikan, that I'm not moving from this circle. Ad shetirachem abanecha. Until you have mercy on your children. Hitchilu gishamim min natfin. In response, rain began to trickle. Amar, Honi said, Lo kach sha'alti. I didn't ask for just such a trickling little drizzle. Ela gishmei vorot shichinu merot. But ample rains that will fill the water holes, the ditches and the caves. We need to have some drinking water around here. Hitchilu lered bezaf. The rains began to fall with a fury. Amar, lo kach sha'alti. I didn't ask you for this furious rain. Elagish me ratzon b'chav en nidava. But I need rains of goodwill, of blessing. Gentle rains, but serious rain. Yardu ketikanan. The rains fell as they normally should fall. That's exactly the way Honi needed them to fall. Ad shiyatzu Yisrael miYerushalayim b'har habayit. Until the Jews had to leave Jerusalem for the Temple Mount. They had to run up to high ground. The rain was coming, and it kept coming. Mipnei ha-geshamim. Because of those rains. Ba'u v'amru lo. The people came to him and said, Kashem sheit palalta aleim sheyeldu, just as you prayed for the rains to fall, kach hitpalel sheyelchu lahem, pray that they cease, pray that they cease. Amar lahem, he says to them, se'uru in nimchet even hato'in, go out and see if the stone of the strayers has been effaced by the water. Unless that's the case, in other words, I'm not going to pray for the rains to cease. Now, the stone of the strayers is this stone that is the lost and found stone, right? Rambam takes this into halachic codes. In the ancient world, how do you do lost and found? You find something, you bring it to a certain stone that is kind of like your public lost and found. It's like going to the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and that's the lost and found over there. This is the lost and found stone in the Jerusalem area. See if it's underwater. Shalach lo Shimon ben Shetach. Shimon ben Shetach sends him the following message. Ilmaile choni ata, were you not choni, gozerani alecha nidui, I'd ban you. You're lucky you're choni. Aval ma etzeh lecha, but what shall I do to you? Shata mitchate lifnei amakum, for you so sin before the Holy One by boldly demanding all this rain. Voseh lecha ritzoncha, and still he fulfills your wish. Kaben shehu mitchate al aviv, like a son who's completely sinning against his father. Voseh lo ritzono, and yet the father fulfills his wishes. V'alecha ha-katuv omer, concerning such people like you, what does it say? What's the verse say? Yismach avicha ve'imecha v'tagel yoladechtecha. May your father and mother rejoice, and may she who bore you be glad. And that is how Chonei Ha-Ma'agah got his name. Now, were you expecting that ending? Right? The story, it kind of unfolds. And we've got this Choni in the middle of a circle. They need rain. By the way, on the heels of everything that was discussed before, you see that rain comes back to be the focus of the Mishnah, and not necessarily the calamities and the special fasts. There's some disagreements about what we do on those Yotzei Dofen days. There's some disagreements about what it looks like. What really can we declare a fast, even on a Sabbath for? What is so desperate a time that we need to have a fast, and do we do the kind of prayer rite or prayer service that regular fasts call for, regular fast days, or if you will, special fasts that we call because of calamities? Should we do all those prayers on Neinu? Should we blast the shofar? Or is the Sabbath a different day? And do we treat these kind of emergencies differently? And is this the emergency management committee talking in among Chazal about what kind of things constitutes real emergency for which we need to create some response? And is the response, and this is the cool part of the first part of the Mishnah, I'll get back to Choni, are they really saying, well, it's all about prayer, any kind of calamity or emergency that befalls us, or, is Shabbat the time to start thinking, maybe it's a matter of figuring out we're not talking about prayer, we're obviously keeping Shabbat, we're obviously doing the right thing by God in terms of Torah law and the rabbis and the sages, but we allow for the town leaders who are having this discussion to actually go out and get help and figure out how to protect their own cities and their surrounding areas from these emergencies. So part of this Mishnah, I think, is a little bit of that discussion. If someone can say, no, go out and get help versus do the actual tefillot that we deem necessary for a fast.
The discussion seems to appear in some cities that are not Jerusalem. And here now, when the rains come, they're talking about right in the heart of Jerusalem.
Good. So this is a question. We talked about, and I surmised about the surrounding areas. I was trying to figure out what are surrounding areas. Are these surrounding areas only of Yerushalayim? And we're only talking about Jerusalem? And then we get a story about Jerusalem? Is it all of Eretz Yisrael and even beyond that diaspora? And we're talking about emergency management for the whole place? And really, we get back to a story about Jerusalem for some reason that we will tease out in a moment? It seems almost like A doesn't go with B, right? So what do we make of A going with B? What's the Choni story and the Jerusalem story doing after the initial discussion here in Chapter 3 of all of those emergencies for which we might even override our general rule that we don't declare fasts on the Sabbath?
It reminds me of the Sorcerer's Apprentice a little bit in the fable aspect of it, but it seems to be an alternative to fasting and blowing the shofar. There are people with special skills, capabilities, relationship with God.
Great. So I think that's exactly what the one argument is with the second half. We called upon the community to make a special fast. We talked about mit'anin, we talked about matri'in, fasting and blowing shofar. We didn't turn to our one ben bayit Etzel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We didn't turn to that star we had, that Honi represents in the second part of the Mishnah,
although it's,
to cry out for us.
It is implicit in the Zakimi that it's not quite the Ben Bayit, but it's the elders who fast before they even ask for the whole community to fast. So there seem to be levels of...
Ah, but it doesn't really say that in the beginning of chapter 3,
not,
right?
Not here, but we did have it.
We had it before.
Before.
But over here, we were truly concerned, and out of account of being truly concerned and it being an emergency situation, we were ready to actually call everybody to fast, pray, and sound the shofar on Shabbat. The alternative, I think, is Panu El Honi. No, wait a minute. Did you need to have the whole community fasting and blowing the shofar? Why didn't you, like our example from Jerusalem and in Eretz Yisrael, in Jerusalem, turn to Honi like the children of Israel are said to have turned to him?
But you need a Honi.
You need a Honi. Maybe you didn't have one, so that's an answer we could give. In other words, okay, obvious answer is you didn't have such a Ben Bayit, right? To be so chutzpahdik that you could control such great decisions by Kodesh Baruch Hu, to think that it's you. Maybe the... So that's where the criticism gets, because that's the question of what's the criticism of Honi all about. Maybe the answer was, no, the community does take it on as a community, first part of the Mishnah, because we don't really want this kind of chutzpah. And that's the criticism about Shimon ben Shetach at the end of that story in the Mishnah.
Well, and the story itself has that element of be careful what you do because not everybody can control it the way Honi did.
Yeah.
And even he has problems.
Right. It could be a more general warning in that vein.
It's very rich. I've read it before, but not in context, and it's very rich.
Yeah, it's fantastic when you do read it in context. And you've got this first half of this Mishnah in chapter 3. And you see exactly where it's coming, right? And what more? Let's say more. What's another reason why you have the beginning of the Mishnah and then the Honi story? Let's take it in a different direction. Instead of it being about instead of, like here, maybe this, no, find the Honi, as the example exists in Jerusalem of old, if it's of old, it doesn't have to be. Maybe it's, here's what you start with. And when that fails, because your prayers didn't get answered, the next thing you do is you find someone as spiritually powerful and as spiritually chutzpahdik as Honi HaMagel.
I thought you were going somewhere else. Oh. You do both contemporaneously.
Ah. So that's a third possibility.
If you're going to go to a Honi, you better support him.
I think that's a third possibility.
Yeah.
But over here, it might be a sequential kind of proposition.
Yeah.
Did you have something, Mira? Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
No. It's magical thinking. And it's an interesting what you pointed out. It's not the community fasting. It's not we all guilty and sinners. No. Let's turn to someone who has direct line to God, and he's going to help us. It's kind of magical thinking.
But very common in the Hasidic tale.
Of course. It's going to the...
Not in the tzaddik. As far as I know, in the Rambam.
Going to the tzaddik, to the cemetery and praying on the...
Yes.
The grave of the Rebbe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Believing that there is a special connection there. Probably there is.
I would say, again, because I mentioned this, you know, what is that criticism at the end? Here is an internal polemic in Chazal. They like the notion of a Honi, who's a Ben Bayit Shel Shamayim. who really is a welcome son of, if you will, a son of heaven, right? Here he is, God's going to do whatever he asks, despite his whining and his tantrums and his sarcasm and his thrusting his prayers. Shimon ben Shetach says, woe is your father who lets you speak to him that way and then does everything you wish. So the internal criticism there is all about, I wasn't going to say exactly magical thinking, but let me use it as spiritual, I would agree, Rebbeism. That you have this notion that this one soul can really change everything for Bnei Yisrael down below. If there was no criticism of him and the story simply ended, the people came to him and said to him, just as you prayed for them to fall, pray that they cease. He said to them, I'll do it. I'm going to go and I'm going to say to God, please stop this. And the rain stopped, right? That would be a very different ending than the ending we have.
But there's tension in the ending we have. It's not, yes, Shimon ben Shetach criticizes him, but he's also powerless.
And he offers some criticism. I'm not suggesting that Shimon ben Shetach usurps the power of Honi and the power of the model either. Because the model stands.
Right.
Because he says, may your father and mother rejoice, and may she who bore you be glad. This is part of how Israel will carry on. This is how part of Israel will you know, be treated by God to the tzorech shel ha'sha'ah, whatever it needs in the hour of her need. They know who to turn to, and I know to whom I can't say no. But that internal notion, that dialogue, and that having played out, to fast forward it, in the age of Rebbes and in the age of the power of the tzaddik. There's a wonderful book about the tzaddik as a demut, as a personality.
It's a dangerous situation.
So there's been some deep research on it by Emmanuel Etkis, who's at the Hebrew University, regarding the whole enterprise of the Hasidic leader who takes on for his Hasidim that direct channel to heaven. And when we think about the kind of hope we have in any of our leadership, on the one hand, it's very healthy to think of them as fellow human beings and to not to necessarily believe they had a direct line when it comes to achieving and even attaining some kind of our own personal spiritual power. Because if that other very human being can do so, then I can do so as well. On the other hand, there is something very powerful about being in the presence of people who seem to have this intense connectivity to the heavenly realm. In whatever way that manifests, not to say that they're going to go ask for rain if we have a drought, but there is a certain kind of power of presence in certain of the Rebbes and teachers I've met, and I've come into contact with and been in their courts. That's just unbelievable. And there is that spiritual wisdom that comes through. And certain people are blessed with that. And I would say, sometimes it takes a little bit of chutzpah. Spiritual chutzpah. Just like Honi had.
Well, Judaism is a very personal religion. I mean, it is your relationship with God that's important. It's your prayers that are important. To distinguish us from, for instance, the Christian religion, where it's all through the priest who has the connection and prays for you. Now, We pray directly to God.
Yeah, I would say that we do, except when we want an intermediary, and we make of either others or our avot, imahot, people beyond this world, emissaries of certain types, to bring our prayers on high. we have these traditions. You see it happening right here in the Talmud.
Yeah.
And the answer of Shimon Meshetach wasn't everybody's equal here and has capacity just like you and turning to God and saying, why are you listening to Honi? But inherently in what he's saying, we might hear a little of that. On the other hand, we understood from pages in this Gemara itself that people who have merit are those who are learned, those who could remain calm, whose fire burned within for Torah, but still had an ability to be a mensch within their community and known as the important ones. And the whole Tanit service was, you know, kind of hierarchical in that vein, or at least a meritocracy in terms of who really achieved moral standing in the community and spiritual connectivity. That's a whole different legend, right?
A whole other layer, yep.
Whole other layer of legends. You want to, since you mentioned it, you want to say it out loud?
Lamed Vavnik. Lamed Vav is the two letters translated numerically to 36. Lamed is 30, and there is a belief that at any given time in history there are 36 tzaddikim in existence around, and you don't know who they are, and even they don't know that they are such, but it's a constant number. That belief is very ancient. It's even found in the Rosicrucian movement in Europe. It's very ancient. It goes even to ancient Egypt, that the number itself, 36. But in Judaism, it translated into what I just said. And I used to call my mother-in-law Lamed Vavnik. She was such a tzaddikah, it's unbelievable. So I used to call to say she's a Lamed Vavnik.
Yep.
Because of their existence, the 36 of justice, were they not here, the world would fall out of balance. But our legend is that the Lamed Vavnik definitely are among the Jewish people.
But I believe, you could find within the legend itself that they manifest in all kinds of ways. So there's an interesting, I think it was actually Elie Wiesel who wrote pretty deeply about the legend. And it's a wonderful, wonderful textual tradition. I don't want to go too deeply, because I want to just read the end of the Mishnah before we go. It turns immediately and talks about people who were fasting indeed. So it kind of gave you this Honi story, bookended by the practice of fasting. Obviously, Honi story is not necessarily a story of fasting. Maybe, though, it was happening while they were fasting, and they found the right Sheliach Tzibor. And because it comes with the bookend of fasting, it's gam v'gam, as you said. That's the third possibility. It's happening that they're fasting and they're crying out, and they need someone with such power to be the Sheliach Tzibor in their surrounding areas. We're not talking about Jerusalem for these other people who are worried about wolves in their town. So they're going to find someone as close to Honi as they can. And if he's a little bit spiritually chutzpahdik, okay, you're going to have to accept that, because people who have the power to lead that service might just be on this level of feeling like they're ready to draw a circle in the ground and stand there until God answers them. Right? So I'm just saying in general that I think what you get personality-wise from the story then, knowing that at the end you're talking about those who were standing there and fasting, is to say, we already saw on a couple pages beforehand who you were supposed to choose for Sheliach Tzibor. Remember, if you don't have an elder who's wise, you have a younger person who's hopefully a sage, you don't have that, it's someone who's just suave and good-looking, you know, whose words will enter their hearts when he reprimands them, right? Let someone really, really... Who knows text and tefillot and all the words of the biblical passages that need to be said and the special prayers, who says them beautifully, be the one up there. In other words, let it happen, okay, so beautiful. And if
it's about rains that you were in this practice of fasting. Hayu mit anin, they were fasting from dawn. V'yardu lehem gishamim kodim haneta hama, and rains began to fall for them before sunrise. Lo yashlimu, they need not complete the fast. La'achar haneta hama, if the rains began to fall after sunrise, yashlimu, but they must complete it if it's after sunrise. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Kodim Chatzot, Rabbi Eliezer says that the rains began to fall before midday, lo yashlimu, he gives them till midday, and then they don't have to complete the fast. La'achar Chatzot, but if the rains began to fall after midday, yashlimu, they should fulfill the fast. Oh, so now, wait a minute. Was I really talking about a time when it was called the absolute calamity of the beginning of the Mishnah? Or am I back to just the general picture of rain here, and we're waiting for the rain? But one of the situations in the beginning of the Mishnah was that, what? The rain after the first rain fell didn't fall for 40 days. So I could be talking about some of my situations in the beginning of the Mishnah. But I have to ask, okay, so why am I just back to rain if I was talking about all those calamities at the beginning of the Mishnah? And again, leaving some of these things open. Ma'aseh shegazru ta'anit b'lod. It once happened that a fast was decreed in Lod. V'yardu lehem geshamim kodem chatzot. And rain fell for them before midday. Amar lehem Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon says to them, Su'u v'ichu shutu'u v'asu yontuv. Go out, drink, and make a holiday. You have rain. V'yatzu v'achlu v'shatu v'asu yontuv. And they went out and drank and made a holiday. Uva'u v'ena arba'ayim v'karu halel agadol. And they came back to the synagogue in the afternoon and even recited, Ki le'olam chasdo. Ki le'olam chasdo. God, your mercy is, and your kindness is forever. Lila Tov.